After the conversation ended, I called Hillary and told her about it. Then I told Mac McClarty. I never heard from or saw Roger Porter again until he attended a reception for the White House Fellows when I was president. I wonder if he ever thinks about that phone call and whether it influenced my decision. October 3rd was a beautiful autumn morning in Arkansas, crisp and clear. I started the day that would change my life in the usual way, with an early morning jog. I went out the back gate of the governor's mansion, through the old Quapaw Quarter, then downtown to the old State House, the grand old place where I had held my first reception when I was sworn in as Attorney General in 1977, was already decked out in American flags. After I ran past it, turned, and headed for home, I saw a newspaper vending machine. Through the glass, I could read the headline, "Hour Arise for Clinton." On the way home, several passers-by wished me well. Back at the mansion, I took a last look at my announcement speech. I had worked on it until well past midnight. It was full of what I felt was good rhetoric and specific policy proposals, but still too long, so I cut a few lines. At noon, I was introduced on the stage by our state treasurer, Jimmy Lou Fisher, who had been with me since 1978. I started out a little awkwardly, probably because of the conflicting feelings flooding through me. I was at once reluctant to abandon the life I knew and eager for the challenge, a little afraid, but sure I was doing the right thing. I spoke for more than an hour, thanking my family, friends, and supporters for giving me the strength to, quote, step beyond the life and job I love, to make a commitment to a larger cause, preserving the American dream, restoring the hopes of the forgotten middle class, reclaiming the future for our children. I close with a pledge to give new life to the American dream by forming a new covenant with the people. More opportunity for all, more responsibility from all, and a greater sense of common purpose. The first big test would be in New Hampshire. If I ran poorly there, I might not do well enough in the states that followed to last until Super Tuesday. Though I was running dead last in the polls in mid-November, I liked my chances. New Hampshire's a small state, less than half the size of Arkansas, with very well-informed primary voters who take seriously their responsibility to carefully evaluate the candidates and their positions. To compete effectively, a good organization and persuasive television ads are necessary, but nowhere near sufficient. You must also do well in an endless stream of small house parties, town meetings, rallies, and unscheduled handshaking. A lot of New Hampshire citizens won't vote for anyone who hasn't asked personally for their support. After all my years in Arkansas politics, that kind of campaigning was second nature to me. Not long after I announced my candidacy, President Bush's troubles mounted, as Pat Buchanan announced his intention to enter the GOP primaries with a George Wallace-like attack on the president from the right. Conservative Republicans were upset with the president for signing a $290 billion deficit reduction package passed with the Democratic Congress, because in addition to spending cuts, it contained a 5-cent gas tax increase. Bush had brought the Republican convention to its feet in 1988 with his famous line, "Read my lips, no new taxes." He did the responsible thing in signing the deficit reduction package, but in doing so, he broke his most visible campaign commitment and violated the anti-tax theology of his party's right-wing base. Our campaign seemed to be on track until January 23rd, when a woman named Jennifer Flowers said she had carried on a 12-year affair with me. The Flowers problem reached a fever pitch, but after Hillary and I did an interview with 60 Minutes, the furor died down. On February 18th, the night of the New Hampshire primary, Senator Paul Tsongas of Massachusetts won with 35%, but I rebounded to finish a strong second with 26%, well ahead of my other three opponents, Senator Bob Kerrey of Nebraska, Senator Tom Harkin of Iowa, and former Governor Jerry Brown of California. I spoke to the media early and said New Hampshire had made me the comeback kid. Tsongas had annihilated me in the precincts closest to the Massachusetts state line, but from 10 miles north of there, I had actually won the state. I was elated and profoundly grateful. After New Hampshire, the rest of the primaries and caucuses came on at such a pace that the kind of retail politics New Hampshire demands became impossible to replicate. My first victory was in Georgia on March 3rd. On March 10th, I swept all the southern states on Super Tuesday. Then on St. Patrick's Day, March 17th, I won big victories in Illinois and Michigan, virtually ensuring my nomination, unless I could be derailed in New York. During the lead-up to the New York primary, the Whitewater story hit. The big papers had been camping out in Arkansas for weeks, looking for whatever they could find on my record and my personal life. The New York Times had started the ball rolling in early March with the first of its Whitewater stories. In 1978, Hillary and I, along with Jim and Susan McDougal, took out bank loans of more than $200,000 to invest in land along the White River in northwest Arkansas. Jim was a land developer whom I had met when he ran Senator Fulbright's office in Little Rock. We hoped to subdivide the property and sell it at a profit to retirees. Unfortunately, in the late 70s, interest rates went through the roof, the economy slowed, land sales dropped, and we lost money on the venture. By the time I became governor again in 1983, McDougal had bought a small savings and loan named Madison Guaranty. A few years later, he retained the Rose Law Firm where Hillary worked to represent it. When the savings and loan crisis hit America, Madison was facing insolvency and sought to inject new cash into the operation by selling preferred stock and forming a subsidiary to provide brokerage services. To do this, McDougal had to get permission from the state securities commissioner, Beverly Bassett Schaefer, whom I had appointed. The Times ran a series of articles on Whitewater, questioning whether there was a conflict in Hillary representing an entity regulated by the state, whether Madison had received special treatment in getting its financing proposals approved, and whether Schaefer had exercised appropriate oversight of the institution when it was failing. The facts did not support the accusations and innuendos. First, the financing proposals the commissioner approved were perfectly normal for the time. Second, as soon as an independent audit showed Madison to be insolvent in 1987, Schaefer pushed federal regulators to shut it down well before they were willing to do so. Third, Hillary had billed Madison for a grand total of 21 hours of legal work the Rose Law Firm had done over a two-year period. Fourth, we never borrowed any money from Madison, but we did lose money on the Whitewater investment. That's the essential Whitewater picture. In the face of all the character attacks, I responded as I always did when my back was against the wall. I plowed on. In the last week of the campaign, the clouds began to lift. On April 1st, during a meeting with President Bush at the White House, President Carter made a widely reported comment that he supported me. It couldn't have come at a better time. No one had ever questioned Carter's character, and his reputation had continued to grow after he left the presidency because of his good works at home and around the world. The New York Times and the Daily News endorsed me. Amazingly, so did the New York Post, which had been more relentless in its attacks than any other paper. Its editorial said I had, quote, already survived a battering by the press on personal questions unprecedented in the history of American politics. He has continued to campaign with remarkable tenacity. On April 7th, with a low turnout of about 1 million voters, I carried New York with 41%. We also won in Kansas, Minnesota, and Wisconsin. On April 9th, Paul Tsongas dropped out of the race. The fight for the nomination was effectively over. I had more than half the 2,145 delegates I needed to be nominated, and had only Jerry Brown to compete with the rest of the way in. But I was under no illusions about how badly damaged I had been, or how little I could do about it before the Democratic Convention in July. I was also exhausted. I had lost my voice and put on a lot of weight, about 30 pounds. Soon after the win in New York, I confronted the prospect of a formidable new challenger, H. Ross Perot. Perot was a Texas billionaire who'd made his fortune with EDS, Electronic Data Systems, a company that did a lot of government work, including some for Arkansas. He had become nationally known when he financed and engineered the rescue of EDS employees from Iran after the fall of the Shah. Perot had a blunt but effective speaking style, and he was convincing a lot of Americans that with his business acumen, financial independence, and penchant for bold action, he could do a better job of running the country than either President Bush or I. I spent the first weeks of July picking a running mate. In the end, I decided to ask Al Gore. His selection defied the conventional wisdom that the vice presidential candidate should provide political and geographic balance. We were from neighboring states. He was even younger than I was. And he, too, was identified with the new Democrat wing of the party. I believed his selection would work precisely because it didn't have the traditional kind of balance. It would present America with a new generation of leadership and prove I was serious about taking the party and the country in a different direction. I also thought his selection would be good politics in Tennessee, the South, and other swing states. Moreover, Al would provide balance in a far more important way. He knew things I didn't. I knew a lot about economics, agriculture, crime, welfare, education, and health care, and had a pretty good grasp on the major foreign policy issues. Al was an expert on national security, arms control, information technology, energy, and the environment. On July 8th, I called Al and asked him to be my running mate. The next day, he and his family flew to Little Rock for the announcement. The picture of all of us standing together on the back porch of the governor's mansion was big news across the nation. Even more than the words we spoke, it conveyed the energy and enthusiasm of young leaders committed to positive change. Conventions are heady affairs for the nominee. The Democratic convention in New York was especially so. After months of being told I was lower than a snake's belly, I was now being held up as a paragon of all things good and true. In New Hampshire and afterward, with all the character attacks, I had to fight to keep my temper in check and minimize my tendency to whine when exhausted. Now I had to rein in my ego and remember not to get carried away by all the praise and positive press.